Zyn nicotine pouches deliver nicotine satisfaction anywhere, anytime, which means Zyn pairs well with you, your personality, your schedule, and your spontaneity. Zyn fits easily into your bag, pocket, and into your life because it's smoke-free, hands-free, and hassle-free. So the only person who will know you have a Zyn pouch in is you. Visit Zyn.com or head to your local convenience store today to find your Zyn. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Pause for a big thank you to our partner making today's program possible. It's Dexcom. With the new Dexcom G7, you get better diabetes results without those awful finger sticks. It sends your glucose numbers to your compatible phone or to your watch so you can always see where you are and where you're heading. See how food and exercise affect your glucose. It makes it easier to spend more time in range and lower your A1C. Take more control of your diabetes with the number one recommended CGM brand. It's so easy to get started today at Dexcom.com. Dexcom.com.
Dexcom data on file 2023. If your glucose alerts and readings from the G7 do not match symptoms or expectations, use a blood glucose meter to make diabetes treatment decisions. For a list of compatible devices, visit Dexcom.com/compatibility.
Thanks, Dexcom, for being our partner.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Body Bags with Joseph Scott Morgan.
There's a period of time when young kids stop being babies necessarily, and they become something that resembles a toddler. It's kind of that weird age, you know, and it's so precious. It's precious to see that development of a child as you're watching them grow, you know, your own child. And, you know, they're pulling up on things and they're, what do they call it, cruising. You know, they're holding on to things and walking around. And finally, some of them take those early steps. And it's precious to watch, but oh my gosh, it's terrifying too. I mean, it's probably, if you've never had a small child and you don't know what it's like, there are a few things, and it's amazing. You're going to think that I'm crazier than you already think that I am, but sometimes you look around and you say, where's my child? Because you don't know. You don't know where they've wandered off to in your house, you know, and so you have to watch them every single moment because you're afraid that something is going to befall them. It brings to mind a case that I've been interested in now for a couple of weeks, I guess. It's a case involving an 18-month-old child. An 18-month-old child who was so beautiful and so precious. A gift from heaven, as all children are. But something entered into her space that, I don't know, I guess the only way I could really describe it is malevolence. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags. Dave, I sit here and I'm thinking about my grandchildren right now, and even further back, I'm thinking about my kids when they were babies, and I'm thinking about how fragile and dangerous that age is and how you're just trying to keep them alive, particularly when you're a young parent. Oh. You know, you get older and you have grandbabies, it's another thing. You know, you're careful with them, but you know that they're not necessarily going to break, but you're always worried because they're so dependent upon you and they're so they're so vulnerable to the world.
You gave a great explanation about missing them in your own home. At 18 months, they are fast.
They are fast. You know, you find them in a closet or under.
And the thing is, when they're in the closet, they're usually standing on an old dresser on top of a TV you hid in there next to a dresser that has only three legs. And they're standing on top saying hi. Yeah, that's an 18-month-old right there.
It's terrifying, but they're so darn cute. I mean, they are. They're just so. It's such a sweet age, you know, because they still have that amount of baby in them where they want to crawl up in your lap, and you can rock them, you can soothe them. You know, they're gonna cry. They have these needs, and you can meet them, and all those sorts of things. It's such a precious time. You know,
that's why this story has impacted you the way it has.
Yeah, yeah, it really has. I've often thought about this. You know, when we cover cases involving small children, just bring them to me. Don't destroy them.
Think about it. This story actually began 4 months before it ended.
Yeah,
4 months before, and obviously we're talking about the death of an 18-month-old child named Iris Rita Alfera. She was 18 months old. 4 months before she died, she had spent the weekend with her biological father. The biological mother and father were not together as a married couple. They both had moved on. They shared custody. Shared custody meaning the mom had custody all the time and the dad had visitation about every other weekend. And she did that. That tended to work out for them. After one of Iris's weekends with her dad, her mom noticed when she was changing a diaper, some water beads were in her diaper. These are the water beads that are like in a bathtub, you know, the bathing beads, some people call them. But anyway, she was scared, frightened. What are these beads doing in my child's diaper? And she takes her to the hospital. They thought the same thing. What in the world has she done? What has she eaten? And at the hospital, they watched not just beads pass through her system. A couple of small batteries, the little batteries
batteries.
Yeah.
Like a watch battery almost.
Right.
Yeah.
And a screw, like a wood screw, also passed through her system into her diaper. Now, when it first happened that these passed, that was a warning, certainly. Hey, something's up. Somebody's either not watching her careful enough.
Right.
You know, that they weren't thinking anything heinous. They weren't thinking this child is having to fight a monster. They were actually thinking, wow, you know, this child thankfully did not suffer any long-term effects from this. So when she did start suffering effects and she was at her dad's place for the weekend, dad goes to the grocery store. While he's there at getting ready to pay for his groceries, his girlfriend calls and says, hey, something's wrong with the baby. And he's like, well, call 911. I'm on my way. By the time the rescuers got there, she was lethargic. Iris was not really, her eyes were fixed, and I've got questions about the way they described her, Joe, because I'm not sure. I'm not knowing the medical terms, what it all means. But the bottom line is she died from things that she didn't find on her own. She was fed. And in this particular case, nail polish remover.
Yep.
That would be the best thing to explain it. Nail polish remover, acetone. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, it's acetone. Yeah, it is.
That's what killed 18-month-old Iris Alfera.
Yeah, it's horrible stuff. Let me back up just for a second to give, you know, to give our friends here kind of an understanding of first off, that first part that we were describing. Many people might not be aware of this, but there is actually a condition that adults suffer from, and it's actually referred to as pica. And pica, P-I-C-A, it's actually a condition where people get fixated on consuming non-food items. And I think probably one of the most ghastly examples of this is probably Albert Fish, who was a serial killer back, I don't know, the turn of the last century, I think. And he would ingest metallic objects like needles, nails, all manner of things. But he was, he had pica in the sense that it was a sadomasochistic thing. He enjoyed the pain in his bowel. And that's the thing I got to thinking about this when you had mentioned, you know, the batteries are one thing. It's kind of a smooth external surface. Right. If they're not broken, yeah, that could be easily passed. The water beads, sometimes if those rupture, they've got a dehydrating quality to them that could be quite dangerous. But primarily you're worrying about blockages, but the screw in particular troubled me, because if you swallow a metal object like that, and as it's kind of passing through, well, obviously it has to make its way to the stomach, and then where the stomach dumps into the small intestine, you know, it has to travel some distance, and you're really wondering along the way, if you just imagine, you'd mentioned that this was like a wood screw. Well, this is going to be something that has got, it's got a very sharp point on it, and it's got the spiraling pattern that runs up the side that literally can hang on the mucosal surface of the bowel. Just imagine that just for a second. If it gets in there and it gets twisted, then that means that the bowel can rupture, perhaps. And all kinds of bad things can happen at that point. And the child has no way of communicating this. I think one of the questions I would have, if this was an attempt to take this child's life in some kind of passive way, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's not like the child is being beaten to death, but you try to, it's almost staging. It is staging. Mm-hmm. You want to make it look like the kid picked something up, stuffed it in their mouth, and oops, it was an accident and they died. Yeah. I don't think that you can take the full measure of thinking about providing objects for a child to swallow. And how do you get them to swallow it? Did you take a wood screw and place it into a banana, say, for instance, and give the banana to the child, say, cut up bits of banana? Or maybe you're talking about, it's not a finger food. Maybe you're taking something out of a jar. You know, like, I don't know, like carrots, you know, like pureed carrots, or, you know, one of these peas, or one of these things that's real tacky, and you place that item in there, and then can you imagine taking that spoon and dipping that out? And you
so
know,
your
precisely
first thought wouldn't be
there.
If you're a medical person and you see this, your first thought isn't going to be somebody got this baby to eat a screw. It's going to be she found some things on the floor and was,
oh, yeah,
and just grabbed them and, you know, fingers to mouth, right? I mean,
yeah, you're right. And I have to say, you know, if this is the issue and you're taking the child to the emergency room to be assessed, first off, you're going to do x-rays on the child thoroughly. You know, you want to be able to look through, get a really good image of the bowel, every bit, and the stomach, to see if there's anything what we refer to that's radio opaque in there. Because if there's another item in there and you can find another item, most people, you know, there's a lot of talk out there about how, and you've probably heard this over the years, about how long the human intestine is.
Yeah.
The small intestine in particular, large intestine, it sounds counterintuitive. Large intestine is not as long as the small intestine. The small intestine is really compact. It compacted upon itself. It's in loops. We refer to it as loops. And it goes, it's feet. I mean, just feet and feet and feet. So anything that is passing through there, all these little turns, all these little awkward positions that it can get in. If you've got a foreign object in there, it can get hung up in that gastric mucosa. The surgeon that's tasked with clearing that area out really has hell to pay. You know, when you're going by the image, and of course they're going to scope these kids in order to look for it, but it's a very delicate thing, because if that tissue is harmed in a particular way, you can actually have something like sepsis that might set in that area, because you don't know if the surface of that bowel is ruptured and then it kind of begins to spill out into that surrounding area. You can have all kinds of nasties that set in, and you really wonder, had somebody actually weaponized food in order to kill the child? Hey, Dave, I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
You ever been messing around with super glue and you you get some of it on the surface of like one of your fingers, and then you put your other finger on the surface of the finger that has the super glue, and you're sitting there and you're trying to saying, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? You know, there's all kinds of stories of people that have super glued toilet lids down and all kinds of stuff, you know, from that.
Right.
Do you know what substance can be used to free up super glue?
I do.
Yeah. Actually, acetone. It's an acetone based.
You know how I knew it?
How's that?
Several months ago, there was a story about a woman who used Gorilla Glue on her hair. Getting ready for a big date, ran out of hairspray, went and used Gorilla Glue.
Holy smokes.
Yeah, and her all her hands, her hair, all got glued together. And so I found out that they used acetone. That's how they were able to undo her fingers and hair and everything else. And she wasn't the first one.
Isn't it amazing the stuff we come across? I mean, it really is. But
nail polish remover works at getting rid of glue.
It does. I mean, it's a solvent, you know, and it can, you know, you begin to think, well, what does that involve? If you've ever been around super glue and you've glued something down or you've gotten the residue left behind, how are you going to get that up? Well, acetone is one of the ways that you do it. And acetone is also used to remove fingernail polish. And if you've ever been around fingernail polish, my wife uses it. And has used it over the years. I don't like the smell of either one. I don't like the smell of nail polish. It makes my head hurt. Acetone is not as heavy in the odor, but it's still, you can pick up on the smell of it. And as it's being used, and generally you're in close proximity to your spouse if they're but taking off fingernail polish.
It is strong enough of a smell, you're right, that it's not something you would immediately think, hey, let me taste this.
No, it's not, but it's much like, you know, we've had several cases over the years where we've talked about antifreeze.
Yeah.
And, you know, antifreeze, one of the dangers of it is that it's actually got a sweet taste to it. You know, acetone has a sweet taste to it. So
no, I didn't know
if
that.
So if you're going to use it I use the word malevolence, but in a malevolent way, if you're going to use it to perpetrate a crime like this, it's not like you're taking hydrochloric acid and pouring it down somebody's throat. You're giving them something that has a sweet taste. And what do kids love? Kids love things that are sweet. So if you can just imagine, what would it take to motivate somebody to say, you know what I think I want to do? I want to take an 18-month-old little girl, little precious baby like this, and I'm going to ply her with fingernail polish remover.
Wow.
Gee, I wonder what'll happen. Well, in this particular case, I think, Dave, we have an indication, at least at this point, that some research might have been done.
Well,
in regards to what would be effective in doing harm to someone.
That's why I wanted to set up the interrelationships here with the parents of Iris Rita Alfera, the 18-month-old victim here. I wanted you to be aware very early on that she was not living with her biological parents. She lived with her mom full time, and they lived with her grandparents. Her dad had already moved on to another woman that he was living with, a 20-year-old woman named Alicia Lene Owens. Alicia Lene Owens was there with her the weekend she ended up with all the water beads, the 3-button shaped batteries and the metal screw. She was there that weekend that these were ingested. And when police were investigating, because you've got an 18-month-old girl who is seemingly in perfect health, and her dad is at the grocery store and she's at home with her dad's girlfriend, and they get a call that she has taken ill. And when the emergency crews arrive, Joe, she is awake. She's lethargic. Her eyes are fixed. And she's the girlfriend claims that she's a nursing student and has tried to perform chest compressions to help Iris because she was not. Her story was that she was feeding the baby on the bed. The baby cramped and fell off the bed and hit her head. And that's when she started acting bad, physically ill. That's when the girlfriend calls the dad. The dad says, call 911. He comes home. He gets there about the same time the rescue squad arrives. They look at her and they take her to the hospital. Now, at the hospital, the doctors are like, no way, this just happened. There's something else going on here. This is when they air flight her to another hospital. She dies 4 days later, 18 months old, and goes from being a perfectly healthy girl when dad leaves her to go to the grocery store. And 4 days later, she's dead. And doctors are saying there's something more to this. So they begin investigations. The investigation twofold, because one, she had physical signs of trauma. She did have a hit on her head. She had signs that the doctor said appeared to be inflicted by an adult. It looked like abuse. During the investigation, they found out that Lene Owens had been researching on her phone things that could hurt a child, everyday household items that could hurt a child, everyday household items that could hurt. Who looks for that, Joe? Who uses their phone to look up ways that things that would hurt a child in the home? Not from a safety standpoint.
No kidding, Dave. I mean, if you're entertaining a child, say, for instance, I can't understand what circumstances you would search that out. But let's just say you're going to keep somebody's kid. Gee whiz, I've never kept a kid before. How can I safeguard my house? I'm looking for things that could do harm to them. But when you get this specific and you begin to look for things that actually might wind up in a fatal event, that is a red flag for investigators. And particularly if you do these searches over a long period of time, it almost goes from a circumstantial standpoint, you're seeing somebody beginning to put puzzle pieces together toward a goal which they're looking to accomplish here. And of course, the goal seemingly at this point in time is the death of this child, the removal of this child from this family environment, from, you know, her dad. And because, you know, many times in this blended situation like this, children can become, how can I put this? It's almost, children many times become almost like an accessory on a vehicle that the new owner doesn't want, but yet the vehicle can't operate without them. And that's unfortunate, but that's really kind of the world that many of us have inhabited throughout our lives. There's a lot of unwanted children out there, and there are people that will do harm to children if given an opportunity, if they can be removed from the equation in an environment. So you have to think, you kind of let off this conversation by stating, I think, what is it? There's monsters among us. I think that's what you said. And, you know,
it was the Newsweek articles. The headline about this story was "Monsters Do Exist."
Yeah, monsters, and they do truly exist, and they will go to whatever lengths possible to remove whatever an impediment the child might be, or whatever the circumstances,
right,
to rearrange it so it works to their advantage.
And that's what she was trying to do.
That's a horrible thing. Yeah,
she was trying to get rid of the baby to get out of her boyfriend's life, so he wouldn't have anything to do with his ex. That was what it amounted to. Or that's my opinion. That's what it is. Put it this way, Joe. I had to ask you this, okay? Because the doctors, now, the way she explained it to the medical professionals that show up, that the baby was eating on the bed, she had a cramp, fell off the bed, and hit her head. Doctors at the children's center that reported this to the police, it's the UPMC's Children's Child Advocacy Center. They reported to police that Iris suffered subdural hematoma and bilateral retinal hemorrhages. What is that?
Okay, well, you've got, when we're talking about a subdural hematoma, you have got a, your brain sits inside of a sac, okay? It's called the dura sac, and your brain is awash with cerebral spinal fluid. Okay, so your brain kind of floats in this substance, all right, contained within a sac. The sac, along with the fluid, acts as almost a shock absorber for the brain. If you're talking about a subdural hematoma, that means sub, obviously meaning below. So if you've got a subdural hematoma, that means that the hemorrhage itself is in between the dura sac and the brain. And what does that do? Well, it creates pressure. And if you're talking about this kind of bilateral retinal event, Dave, that's something that we commonly see with shaken baby syndrome. because if you're talking about shaking a child to that point where you're going to inflict not only brain trauma, but also this kind of ocular trauma as well, you've got to have an origin for these points of hemorrhage and that kind of violent shaking that takes place. Now, there's some people out there, there's actually been a long-running debate about is shaken baby syndrome a real thing? Because one of the diagnoses that people would make many times is that you would have these children be bilaterally blinded many times because of the rigorous shaking of the child. And when you've got, say, these optic nerves that are in the back of the eye that lead into the brain, sometimes they can be traumatized. The surface of the floor of the skull is very rough. All right. And it's if it's fractured in any way, or if the kids are jostled in any particular way, particularly over a protracted period of time, you can do great harm to the eyes in that area, not to mention the brain. So you've got the brain with a subdural hematoma where you know that that child, that head is being bounced back and forth all over the place. So the little vessels are going to rupture on the surface of the brain, and you're going to have this pressure that's going to begin to build up as that blood, that focal area of hemorrhage, that clot kind of sets in. And that's going to be problematic. And yeah, it would be glaring, you know, particularly for us at autopsy when her head is actually opened. If you have not seen this on x-ray, you don't know that it's coming. I've actually had these cases, Dave, where we've been in the autopsy room. There's not necessarily any kind of external trauma. Like you're looking at the head, you don't see anything. And then all of a sudden, you open up the head and you're taking back the dura, and there is a big, big hemorrhage right there. And you're thinking, oh my Lord, what's happened here? So we've got trauma, obviously, to the head, that is just in and of itself, Dave, that in and of itself is enough to give investigators pause. You've really got a lot to sink your teeth into there. But now you've got a child that is not only lethargic, which that can be associated with a head injury, but they're not responding. And when they do the lab studies, they discover that the child is going into ketosis, which your body produces ketones naturally. We actually process acetone every day in our system. It's kind of this, it's something that's naturally occurring. It's a byproduct, and we process it. One of the things that acetone does is that it creates ketones, and ketones are produced, I think they're produced in the liver. And so your body is equipped to kind of flush these ketones. You have a spike in ketones many times with diabetic patients, and they can get in real serious trouble with ketosis. And so with her, she's kind of in, you know, as pilots like to say, they were in an what's it referred to as an unrecoverable flat spin. You've got this kid that is in great diminished physical condition. The staff is scratching their heads. They're looking at this and they're thinking, oh my Lord, what can we do to save this child's life? And then, as you said, the admission time was what, two to 3 days in length.
They're trying
mm-hmm. valiantly fighting right. to try to save this child. And no matter what you throw at this situation, you're not going to save her. And so it would be very frustrating, I would think, for a clinical physician and certainly those brave nurses that work with these children day in and day out to sit there and you've got all of this medical science at your disposal. You've got all of these treatments, you've got all of this history and everything, and nothing that you do is going to save this child's life. And you literally just kind of watch them there as they dwindle and dwindle and dwindle until finally they're dead. Well, and there's nothing you can go back and do about it.
In this case, one of the doctors said that based on her condition, that there's no way her dad didn't recognize that something was not recognizable in this child before they called 911. Because the story was that dad went to the grocery store, and while girlfriend was watching the baby, fed her, and that's when all of this happened. And the doctor was saying there had to have been more noticeable stuff going on. But when they get her to the hospital, and as you mentioned, they're treating what they see, they're treating what is obvious, but they don't know until after they do the autopsy about the acetone. Is there a test that one would give a baby that they would look? Would you look for acetone or some type of thing like that that could cause organ failure? Is that on the chart of things to look for?
And I guess you're talking about when they're in the clinical phase in the hospital.
Yeah, she's in the hospital and she's dying. Her organs are failing. And, you know, they've got the subdural hematoma. You got the problem with the retinal area. You've got that, but she's not responding to treatment, as you mentioned.
And so I think that I would think that probably they're going to suss out this idea of the ketosis pretty quickly and try to determine what the origin is with it. And maybe by the time they get this thing figured out, it's too late at that point in time. There's nothing that they can do to stem it.
Okay.
And so, you know, for us at the medical examiner's office, we have a luxury, you know, in medical legal death investigation. We're not trying to save anybody's life.
Right.
We're trying to solve a mystery at this point in time. So it takes some head scratching. It also takes a review of all of the charted material, everything from the moment that this baby would roll through the door in the emergency room, then up to the floor, and then she was transported to another location. All of that data would be gone over. All the nursing notes, all the doctor's notes, anything, any measures that they would have taken to try to stem this condition, that's all going to be considered at autopsy. And then that's going to lead the forensic pathologist at the end of the day, after they balance all of this and they take a look at her tissues, certainly post-mortem, look at everything microscopically, take all of the history into consideration, that's when they're finally going to make this diagnosis. And I think that the forensic pathologist finally had a eureka moment, you know, where they said, yeah, this is acetone poisoning. And look, this doesn't happen a lot, okay? And I don't want to reduce this down to the death of this little angel down to some kind of academic exercise, but it happens with such rarity that this methodology would be something that a forensic pathologist would probably study and actually publish a paper on. Right. That's how, you know, infrequently it happens. Mm-hmm. They would discuss this at a meeting with other physicians to say, or other pathologists to say, look, I had this case. This is something you need to watch out for. It's not like, you know, if we deal with, all manner of trauma, we mentioned the head trauma, that's something that we see regularly, but you know, we see gunshot wounds and bludgeonings and stabbings and all that stuff, certainly motor vehicle accidents. But this is something, it's not absolutely positively has never happened. It has happened. We've got a lot of literature on it, but it's not something that you're going to see every single month. Maybe you won't even see one a year.
Okay.
So when it happens, it's significant.
And that way, once that did happen, her death was ruled a homicide, and the investigation began. And that's when the 4 months previous that we told you about at the very beginning, that's why it was so important to know that. I think that was a trial run 4 months earlier of the button, the batteries that were like buttons, the water beads, and the screw. And as they were investigating, they said, well, okay, not uncommon for an 18-month-old to swallow things. Look, I don't know a parent that hasn't found something in a diaper and went, please tell me that was after. No, that did not pass, please. Thankfully, kids do stick stuff in their diaper. You know, it doesn't all come through their system first because, boy, I got two kids that would have not survived. But but in this particular case, they started that and went, okay, that's explainable. But as they started looking into that happened when the child was at her dad's house with this girlfriend. And so they start examining dad's phone, girlfriend's phone, and they find out that girlfriend has been researching for 9 months, Joe. This child is 18 months old, and for half of her life, this 20-year-old girlfriend was looking up, if your child drinks a lot of nail polish remover, what happens? That was one of the topics that Ms. Owens researched. What happens if a baby eats nail polish? Another of her search, and she tells on her cell phone, in how many cases have kids died from eating water beads? Think about that for a minute. Because what happened 4 months earlier? Water beads. So the police had this investigation pretty much from the very beginning zeroed in. Now it was a matter of going to Joe Scott Morgan and saying, how do we put all this together? You know, I'm going to put it together on my police detective hat here. And I see how these, how do we connect them all medically, Joe?
Well, I think that, again, it's going to be the preponderance of the evidence relative to her clinical treatment. But then you take this, and here's the really ominous piece to this. Not that all of this isn't ominous, but when you begin to talk about a nine-month period, first off, if I were a prosecutor and I was working in a location, which this case is out of Pennsylvania, and I was working in that location, does the word premeditation mean anything here? You know, because, you know, we talk, you know, people, and our friend Nancy Grace always says, let me see if I can do my best imitation. She says, Joe Scott, premeditation can be formed in the twinkling of an eye. And you're right. I mean, it can be formed in a twinkling of an eye. Dave, 9 months ain't a twinkling of an eye.
Buddy.
You're talking about a record. just frame this. You're talking about, allegedly, a record that they have now of her activities stretching back 9 months. 9 months, Dave, where the prosecution is going to present this case because it hasn't gone to trial yet.
Right. Oh, and by the way, Joe.
Yeah.
During the 4 days that this baby was in the hospital before she died, Alicia Owens' cell phone researched numerous times how to pass a polygraph test.
Ah. And let me guess, how'd that work out?
She actually was charged with murder. This has not been adjudicated yet. This is an ongoing case. Because of the homicide charges, she was denied bail, and we will follow it up and we'll update this particular podcast and probably do an update, because there will be more information on what Alicia Lene Owens is accused of doing and why Bailey Jacoby, the father, was not charged and still has not been charged with any wrongdoing in the death of his daughter. We'll have to get an update on that as well, Joe.
You're right. And I think looking at this, this doesn't require a polygraph to be able to understand and to interpret that something that was absolutely pure evil was perpetrated on this gift sent straight down from heaven. I'm Joseph Scott Morgan, and this is Body Bags.
Zyn nicotine pouches deliver nicotine satisfaction anywhere, anytime, which means Zyn pairs well with you, your personality, your schedule, and your spontaneity. Zyn fits easily into your bag, pocket, and into your life because it's smoke-free, hands-free, and hassle-free. So the only person who will know you have a Zyn pouch in is you. Visit Zyn.com or head to your local convenience store today to find your Zyn. Warning, this product contains nicotine. Nicotine is an addictive chemical.
Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox?
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.